Okay, here we go. The training world is full of technical editing courses that don't teach the high-end creativity that viewers expect. Inside the Edit was created specifically to teach you every single creative skill you'll ever need to mesmerize your audience. Hello again, dear friends, and welcome back to episode 11 of Once Upon a Timeline, the official podcast of Inside the Edit. I am your host, Paddy Bird, and I have to say, I'm really excited with what we've got in store for you today. We have our second guest on the show, and this is the first in another two-part conversation where we talk to an editing artist whose work we love. So I was having a documentary binge on Netflix recently, and I kept on seeing the same name popping up in the credits as the editor. I always keep my eye out and make a mental note of great editing work. And because I was seeing the same name so frequently, I decided to look this person up. I discovered Will Znederek, who's had a prolific decade cutting documentaries in LA under the mentorship of the legendary Angus Wall, the only editor to win two Oscars consecutively. I think Will's work is beautifully crafted. It's incredibly powerful and really emotional in so many amazing ways. And so I thought I'd reach out and see if he wanted to be a guest on Once Upon a Timeline. He's such a cool guy, he's so intelligent, and he loves talking about our craft. And so I was really happy when he said yes to coming on the show. For a bit of homework and context for our chat with Will, I would thoroughly recommend watching some of his fantastic documentaries. You can catch most of them on either Netflix or Disney Plus or Hulu, depending on where you are in the world. There's The Black Godfather, Quincy, Five Came Back, Jane, and The Killer Inside, The Mind of Aaron Hernandez. As always, you can go over to the episode page, episode 11, we are this week, at podcast.insidetheedit.com. And we put the trailers to so many of Will's films on there to get you excited for the show. But for this episode, you really got to watch Winter on Fire, which we discuss in the latter part of the show. This is Will's Oscar-nominated documentary that tells the story of the student demonstrations in Ukraine over the winter of 2013 and 2014. Will also has a very interesting trajectory with his career, which he talks about in detail as well. And he also has a ton of unique insights into our craft and how he developed his creative process in long-form documentaries. There's a huge amount of valuable insight and wisdom from this two-time ACE Eddie Award winner. And I know you're going to love what he has to say about our art form. Will, thank you so much for joining us, mate. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be on the show. Paddy, thank you so much for asking. It's quite an honor to be here, I have to say.
Oh, thank you, mate. Thank you for the kind words. I know it's a preliminary question, but it's the kind of thing that I always want to know. How did you get your start in editing? What was your kind of career trajectory?
Good question. I am one of those people who went to film school, but you're not going to film school being like, I want to be an editor, or at least back in the day, you weren't. It was like, oh, I'm going to be a director. I'm going to be, you know, this incredible auteur. I love all these films. You know, I grew up in the 80s, so the Spielberg, Lucas, all that type of thing. And actually ended up going to USC, which Lucas went to. And so there's a lot of that type of mythos there. And at some point, I got into cinematography, and I think it's an interesting thing to sort of talk about cinematography versus editing a little bit, because I think they're both the sort of preeminent crafts of cinema. And cinematography is just very visual. It's very obvious what it is. And you can analyze a film in terms of its cinematography until the cows come home. It just grabs you. And that was something me and my friends would often talk about, is how things were shot, how they were lit, the composition of things, wide angle, close up, all the camera movements. Like, that was a sexy aspect of films. And so I DP'd some films, and that was the sort of trajectory I was starting to go on. But at some point, I think maybe it was a grad film I had shot that were like night shoots. And I was having a very difficult time connecting with the director. And at a certain point, after a very tiring week, I started to feel like, you know what? I don't know if this is for me. I'd like to maybe just show up in a room with a cup of coffee and sit down and actually sculpt something. I was starting to see the creative potential of the edit room.
And you get free biscuits as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And if it's raining, you're still dry. And if it's cold, you're warm inside, and vice versa. And it felt more civilized, I guess you could say. And that coincided with me moving back to New York. I was like, I'm going to take over the town. I'm 23, full of piss and vinegar. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to take all of this film school experience and just take it over, you know. And I started calling all the big post houses and production companies, and couldn't find any traction. So it was a humbling experience when I went to the temp agency and put on a suit and played receptionist for a day or two at a bank, and somehow ended up at an ad agency in the AV department. And that is where the editing journey starts in earnest. And looking back, it was great. It was really great in terms of talking about the art of commercials and advertising. And I think I've brought a lot of that into my documentary editing. You know, I was thinking, you know, my story is a little bit more of the tortoise versus the hare. It's a little slower, but steady growth the whole time. And part of why I think I'm sort of promoting that for some of your audience members who are wondering, you know, who are ready to just come out of the gate and just kill it. I'm so grateful that it was a slow, methodical process for me, because what happened is I was able to grow as a person in terms of emotional intelligence. And I couldn't be doing the work I'm doing now, say 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. There's the life experience that you gain and how that helps you grow as a person if you let it, that helps me key into certain things in terms of the choices I'm making today as an editor. So I'm so grateful for that. But going back to advertising, so I was an AV guy, and I'll try to sneak onto the Avid and try to cut little things, little freebies for people, and just be motivated in that regard.
What year are we talking about here?
This is 1998, and Avid had just come out recently, maybe a few years prior. So ended up back in New York at ad agencies, working in windowless rooms with stacks of VHS decks and 3/4-inch decks, and cutting focus group videos for meetings, but learning about marketing, learning about strategy, learning about how the thinking that goes into a 30-second commercial is profoundly huge. And to see all that thought and see how they think that stuff through, and you boil it down to 30 seconds. So each frame is bursting with energy and power, and starting to cut my teeth on that format really helps you make those tough choices early on. I mean, where every frame is so important. And that's something I try to impart to the young ones coming up. They tend to overcut. I mean, that happens with me in my first cuts too. It's a natural thing. You know, they're just fatty. They're overlong. And I think that just helps you see what the shape of a thing is going to be, and that's fine. But with the turnaround time and commercials and how short it already is, I remember struggling with that for years. And as an assistant editor, you know, my editors would give me things to cut, and I'm grateful for that experience. But I remember being terrified with, you know, getting some footage and then just being frozen, looking at dailies in the timeline and just being frozen. Like, where do you even start? I just remember that fear. And sometimes I still have it, but, you know, commercials help me get to the heart of what it is you're trying to say in the most efficient way possible, while still carrying feeling. the thing about ads is also, you know, how do you engage with customers is through emotion. You know, I'm really learning all this stuff and I'm going through the grinder on all this stuff.
Mm. Commercials are such a great, you know, launching pad because, as you say, it's like you got such little time to connect with an audience, set up what you're trying to say, show them, pay it off and all that kind of stuff. You know, all the kind of classic things in narrative. You got, and every second, you know, it's funny that, you know, if I were to ask a lot of other editors who hadn't come from commercials, they'd say every second counts. And you're not saying that. You're saying every frame counts because you've only got 30 seconds.
Well, yeah, a second is a lot of real estate in the 30-second canvas. I often make the analogy. I make the analogy that editing a commercial is like painting on a grain of rice and cutting a feature is painting the side of a building. I mean, that's how different
nice.
It feels.
Yeah, lovely. Yeah,
but you know, you get a lot of smart. The thing about ads is you have a lot of smart, creative people, and part of that is because they're smart enough to try to collect a big paycheck while they're developing their writing career or their painting career or whatever creative aspect they're trying to get into. And for me, that's cinema and that was film. But I found myself, you know, in these windowless rooms cutting focus group videos about irritable bowel syndrome or foot fungus. And I'm not even kidding.
Wow.
at some point I was like, I don't know about this, but I got to get out of this. But you work with a lot of smart, interesting people, and some of those relationships help you down the road in a great way. But you're gaining skills, and at a certain point, I remember this was a mantra I was carrying around, which is like, gosh, I want to use these powers for good. I feel like I'm gaining skills, and I'm really feeling more confident in my craft. And you're working so hard. I mean, you're applying so much effort to sell hamburgers at the end of the day. And so you're excited about what you're doing on a craft level, and you're trying to gain a reputation so that you can work on that better stuff. But it's a bit deflating at the end of it. And then it's also like, no one's going to talk about this in a year, much less in a month. And so you're feeling like your work is also just disappearing, you know, into the sands of history. And so I started really calibrating towards feature and TV longer form work. And a lot of that, it started becoming docs because I started doing more doc commercial work.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a really interesting topic to get into. I think there's two things that certainly our listeners would like to know, and me as well. One is, how did you make that jump from commercials to docs? And I think that's a really interesting question because as many people new to the craft don't really know, you do tend to get pigeonholed in one genre and it's hard to jump from one genre to another genre. So I'm always interested as to how people, it took me a long time to go from daytime TV to reality TV, from reality TV to docs. That was my kind of path and it was difficult. So I'm always interested in other editors' experiences. What happened for you?
I think this speaks to the permeability in commercials and that idea of you have people doing commercials who also have their feet in other realms. And that's what happened ultimately with me. And this speaks to relationships, which I think is important, very important. But as I'm coming up, you know, the superstar editors at the company are doing the 30-second spots. And then I'm more of an emerging editor at that point. And I'm cutting the web pieces. So that was a relatively novel idea. Oh, let's also take this material and it's doc style material and let's see what we can mine out of it and put it up on the website or YouTube or whatever it is. Now it just happens. But back then it was still relatively new. This is like mid-aughts, 2000, maybe 2008. And so I'm working on that. The producer at the ad agency, also really talented, was working on, and the cinematographer, they were working on spinning off and creating their own production company, a production company called East Pleasant. And at that point, I left the editing company to freelance, or I should say more accurately, I was let go. But that's another life thing. But half
never,
the company
never got, admit that.
Well, half the company got let go because the business started changing. I mean, this was a place that was like a dinosaur in a land of, you know, mammals starting to walk upright. The business was changing so rapidly, and I think a lot of companies had a hard time keeping up. And I went freelance right at that moment, and I needed that little extra push. I'm not sure if I would have went without that. And I'm so, again, I'm so glad that happened. I built up enough relationships with clients and producers and directors that I started working immediately. And then I ended up at this production company with some of these people I'd worked with on the advertising side. And that was much more focused on quote unquote new media. And that encompassed short doc series. And I spent a lot of time around ad work with them working on a feature doc. That was a little bit more like on the side, you could say, but spent a lot of time working on that and putting a lot of effort and energy into that because I found I really loved it, really enjoyed it, really loved applying all that hard work and skill to something that was going to live on. It would come out and it would be a movie and a film exists forever. And I really enjoyed that. And I was like, yeah, I really want to focus more on this and started being more upfront about that, being more open about that.
A really interesting question I'd like to ask you there, mate, would be just thinking back to my career, I remember going from 2-3 minute spots to my first kind of half hour, these kind of pivotal times in my career. And I went from 30s to 60s and then 60s to 90s. And every single one, I remember being terrified, thinking, how on earth am I going to, I've only done like a 2-minute, 3-minute piece here, loads of them. I've done loads and loads of these, but it's a whole different type of editing, keeping an audience on the edge of their seat or at least interested for a longer duration. Did you know, talk to me about that transition from, you know, 30 seconds all the way to kind of shorter docs and stuff like that.
You know, it's funny, actually, I felt the opposite. I think a 30 second canvas is so terrifying.
Wow.
Because it's so limiting. And as you get bigger, it's a little bit more of a relief. It's like, oh, okay, I could keep more of this in and I don't have to put the straitjacket on, as it were.
That's really interesting.
And a lot of these like web ad type things varied. It was, you know, it could be 2 minutes, it could be 4 minutes. It varied based on what felt the best as far as the edit goes. And so in a lot of ways, it was liberating and it naturally continued to extend, but always with the notion of like keeping it as short as possible. Like making it as impactful as possible, but not needing to sacrifice stuff that you really loved or felt were powerful just because you're trying to make a 30 second thing. So you can make a powerful 2 minute piece that really sings. And if that's how long it wants to be. And so in that sense, that felt good. And I started developing, because this material is doc material, I started developing a way of pulling selects that I still use today. I use text cards. And when I'm pulling selects, I pull selects and then clump them together based on idea or theme or whatever the deeper thing that's going on is. Because, you know, in a conversation, it's very nonlinear. Let's talk about interviews, for example. It's very nonlinear. You can have somebody, let's just say they had a bad experience with their father, and that comes out about 10 minutes in. And then 40 minutes in, that same idea comes out in a much more emotional, deeper way. And when I'm pulling selects, I'll put those things together and call it, you know, relationship to father, for example. And so when I talked about being terrified when I started doing like a 30-second commercial and I'm just staring at dailies and I don't know what to do, at least this gives me a start point. I don't need to know what to do. I just need to listen and react and pull and organize, organize by theme. And that's all I need to do. So it's not as taxing. It's not as fearful. You know, you can jump in and you're actually editing in the back of your head when that's happening. Because on the text card, I'll also write out, oh, maybe this is a way to start it. Or this connects to the idea of running away from home or something like that. And you're already starting to build connections on a wider level. And, you know, if something pops, you know, I could put an asterisk in the text or I'll usually lift that up onto another video layer. So because for me, it's very visual. Like I like working in a timeline and I like looking at, I'll color code things. And when I'm talking about clumps, they're like, they end up being these strings of islands on the timeline. And obviously I'll use multiple timelines if that's what it wants, but, and I'm organizing things based on if I think it's a beginning thing or a middle thing or a third act type thing. And so it's already making huge leaps forward as far as overarching structure and writing. And what you find, like, oh, this idea is really, there's a lot of material here and it's a lot of great material. And I didn't think this was the core idea, but as I'm going through this stuff, it's showing itself to me that this is something important. And then, you know, the wheels start going. It's like, okay, why is that important? And you start, your perspective shifts a little bit based on what the material is showing you. So I was already developing something like that with these short web documentaries. And so that's an idea that you can just scale up. And so when I was starting to cut this feature called Mission Blue, which is currently on Netflix, although they kept working on it for years after I did, but there's still some of my fingerprints in there. But I spent a good while working on that and trying to find the shape of it and further refining and developing this technique of using text cards and selects. And also part of it is when you're writing something out, you're imprinting it a little firmer into your neurons. And so it helps you translate. Like if you have to take 10 minutes of sound bites and things and write two sentences or a sentence about what it's about, it really helps you distill what the core idea there or the core concept is or what the main thing you want to communicate is. And then when you go back to it, you don't have to re-listen to all of this stuff. You could just pop through the text cards quickly to re-acclimate yourself in terms of what's there. And oftentimes as you're cutting something, it changes, and something you didn't think was a major idea or where there's a line, you can immediately go back there. There's no lag time. You know exactly where it is. You know what it is. And so it helps speed things up a little bit later. So at the front of the process, you're sitting there and you don't have anything to show people per se. You can show them selects, but I call it invisible work. But it speeds things up so much on the other end of the cut. So it's like when I say editing is like sculpture, which again, I think Thelma Schoonmaker said that at one point, but it really feels tactile and physical almost. I've got these blocks and these pieces, and why that initial select pull is so important is because I'm taking it out of its raw context.
Mm. It's a subtractive art form.
Yeah. To a degree, you're taking things out of the raw context and you're activating them as sculptural elements.
Mm.
And then you can play in terms of how that stuff fits together or doesn't fit together or creates new shapes. And so that's where it's fun. That's where it really lights me up and gets exciting.
I mean, it's really interesting always listening to other editors talk about their process and looking at the similarities and differences in certainly what I do. And I think everyone is slightly different, and it doesn't really matter what the process is. It's how fast and how well we get to the destination of creating a good scene, creating a good act, creating a good film. But I'm eminently fascinated by that. And there's so many little things there that you said, which are really, really cool. It's almost like we invent our own little language that can only be understood by us, and our own system of codes and colors and stuff like that, and timelines, and, you know, how we name our timeline, and, you know, A versions, B versions, C, but you know, whatever it is, it's all these kind of little nuances that are just so, so cool.
Yeah, there's no standard. I mean, everybody does their own thing. It's complete.
Yeah. Wild West.
Yeah, it's all correct. I love hearing assistants. I heard a conversation not too long ago where somebody was coming in to help another editor's assistant, and they had to try to decode that editor's language. You know, because right. You can't just, it's not, everyone's speaking a different editorial language, I guess, in terms of how they work. And that's fun. It's individual.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, the second question, which, you know, I'd love to hear as well, the second part of this question is, why documentary? You know, why not drama? Or obviously you started off in a much shorter form, the shortest form, you know, shorter than news or music videos. Why documentary? I'm always interested in that.
Well, you know, I got into it organically via the type of commercial work I was doing, which became more and more based in documentary form. And this company I was working with, they really specialized in that type of work. and I really enjoyed it. And I think there's something liberating as far as being an editor in that medium, which I really enjoy as well. I mean, so much of it happens in the edit, and I really love that process. It's liberating, I guess, is the right term. But I haven't had as much experience working with scripted to confidently tell you the difference. I could just say that for me, I respond to doc editing because of how much it's really about writing and shaping, and there's no constraints. If you're allowed the freedom to explore and discover and utilize, you can really find magic. And that's exciting. You know, in a lot of ways, you're very much a collaborator with the director, and you really work together to hone something and to find something on a level that I'm not sure you necessarily get that as much on the scripted side. But again, I'm not sure, but I'm so satisfied in terms of the work I'm doing in docs, and it's so interesting to me. In every project, you know, I'm trying to be genre agnostic for that same reason. I want to push myself, you know, I want to take these skills and techniques and apply them to all different types of styles and all different ways to tell a story, because I want to see what I can do. I want to see what the medium can do. You know, I want to see what different styles I can play with, again, because it gets exciting and interesting, and that brings it alive. You know, if you have like a your own quote unquote style, and then you're just stamping that onto the next group of dailies, interviews, archive, you know, then it becomes rote. And I think that shows in the work. I think your feeling that you're applying to the material, how you feel when you're putting it together, gets translated. I just think, you know, you're transferring your own vibes to the audience. I know it sounds a little metaphysical, but, you know, the choices you're making, and you're working with your conscious and your subconscious, you know, those choices reflect your energy and your state of mind. They just naturally do. And that's how the audience reacts to the choices that you're making. So I'm always trying to make the work as alive as possible, which means I have to feel activated by the material I'm working on, which means it's got to push me. It's got to like take me into some uncharted territory creatively for me to really tap into that.
I mean, it sounds like
your question.
It doesn't matter. It's a great answer. Just I'll ask one question. You answer a much better one. It's fine, mate. It's great. I love it. I mean, it kind of like what you're discussing there, or what you kind of reached at the end, which is really interesting. You're talking about flow. And yeah, one of the things consistent about flow is that it happens when you do get into that zone of creativity, when you literally look at the clock and 9 hours have gone by and you haven't even noticed. I mean, that's just that beautiful creative state. You're just so embroiled and impassioned about the whole thing that you just you go into time dilation. That a lot of the time it happens right at the edge of our capabilities. So it's interesting you talk about that, which is if everything's easy and it's fine and we're just doing cookie cutter type creativity, then you don't really go into it. You're kind of doing the, you know, but when we push ourselves right to the edge of our abilities, that's when we go into flow. And I think that speaks volumes for the type of original content that we put out, you know, and not just go with the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, I think a lot of your editor listeners will appreciate losing time, turning around and finding you've missed a meal or the sun's gone down and wondering where all that time went.
Yeah, no, amazing.
But I think also me getting further into documentary filmmaking and longer form documentaries, I think coincided with more opportunity in the doc world. And also, I think you often hear we're talking about this is a golden age of documentaries. Mm. A lot of that has to do with the technology of how you acquire material, digital cameras and the ubiquity of editing software and how you can put that stuff together makes it easier, as opposed to when you had to purchase film, very expensive, and how difficult it was to get that type of equipment. Beyond that, I think also the distribution for documentaries becoming much wider. And again, that's streaming and digital, versus going to the theater. There's something about, I think, going to the theater just invites more of a popcorn type experience, whereas documentaries never really caught fire as a theatrical type thing. But when you're at home, it's just much easier. And so the confluence of events there, I'm so lucky to be in that slipstream and apply all the stuff I learned and loved growing up as a film lover, going to film school, working in advertising and making commercials. All that stuff comes together and I'm so lucky to be able to put together a career based on cutting documentaries that to me tickle that cinema bone in a way they probably didn't 15 years ago.
Yeah, that's a really interesting subject about how documentaries have changed very, very quickly over the last 10 years. That's a fascinating subject to talk about, how a lot of docs have got much more of a cinematic look now.
Yeah, and I don't even think it's a debate anymore, but I remember some years back having conversations where it's like, oh, what's true? You know, what's quote unquote true in a documentary? And this idea of trying to find objective truth. And, you know, you can knock that down right away by just being like, well, where do you place the camera? I mean, right off the bat, you're making choices. So objective truth isn't something to necessarily go for. When you're talking about documentary, you're taking a perspective, you're taking an angle in some form, but you have ethics. You know, you've got to try to be in the spirit of the truth of a thing. I mean, there is, you know, you can just manipulate something away from its actual reality, and that's unethical. So what I try to do, you know, you're dealing with these ideas of ethics on these types of projects where you're not necessarily on a scripted thing. You are if it's based on reality, and there's another barrel of ethics to deal with that type of material. But on docs, it's very much forward. You know, with Winter on Fire, you have people being killed. And I remember having conversations with my director on that and really wondering, you know, how do we treat this? How do we do this? And, you know, at one point, I think he said, you know, this is like building a memorial or a monument to these individuals. You know, it's just not a statue. It's a film that can stand the test of time, and that's the best way to honor their memories. And so you can really go deep on those types of things. But I think, you know, in terms of technique, it's also, you're liberated in the sense of, like, maybe if you're trying to get objective reality, your camera's static and it's just a flat composition or something. But when you realize there are ways you can express something that's real and it can have style and still be real, finding what that boundary is, I wouldn't even call it a boundary. You're just, again, you're trying to connect with real emotions.
Would you say it's a blurred line between documentary and entertainment in terms of, you know, in documentary, you would think that ethically we have to be a lot more pure and we would not have the same kind of license that we would in a more kind of entertainment-based documentary / observational documentary / reality TV. You know, it goes all the way down the spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's more of semantics, you know, in terms of entertainment. It's probably a more viable word would be engagement. You know, you don't make a doc and set out to entertain people. I mean, I suppose it depends on the subject matter, but you're trying to engage people no matter what. I mean, if you've got something important to say, if you're trying to bring to light an injustice, if you're trying to illuminate a serious but underseen aspect of civilization or society, you want people to engage with that work. It's so important for them to do that. Otherwise, you're just wasting your time. If you're putting information forth and nobody shows up, does it exist? You know, and there's information out there in many forms in terms of books. And we often say, like, the comparison is a Wikipedia page, you know. So what makes a documentary different than a Wikipedia page, a moving Wikipedia page, you know, is that what we're calling cinema language, you know, and engaging in terms of style, like cinema language is style. And there's a grammar there, and it's based on touching people's emotions and hitting them in the gut. And you're doing that in service of the actual thing, the thing that's important, the thing you're trying to communicate. So in the edit room, every choice you're making is based on engagement. Mm. So I would say it's not really a blurred line. It's just a question of how you're looking at it and what you're getting to at the end of that. What used to be the boundaries of documentary are constantly being pushed right now. And that's what makes it creatively exciting.
Yeah, I mean, this does go back to this whole idea around how certainly factual and dry documentaries were 20, 30, 40 years ago. I mean, they were a very different beast, a very different feeling, very different emotions, very different purpose. And as the world changes and how, you know, it's kind of like documentary has taken on a whole new cultural reference and influence from everything around it, which is a lot more powerful, I think, than certainly when I started out. I mean, when I started out, documentaries looked very, very different. And I'm just like, it is a renaissance at the moment. You're just like, I'm completely dumbfounded by tuning into Netflix or whatever kind of streaming service. I'm like, oh my God, this looks really... And you watch it and you're like, that is a great piece of work. And it's so engaging. That's the kind of documentary you'd only see 20 years ago. You'd only see that once a year. And now they're just popping up all over the place. And it's really beautiful to see.
Yeah, it becomes a viable option for a Friday night. Whereas when I was growing up, I mean, I wonder how much of this stuff I would engage with as a child. But when I was growing up, for me, the most exciting thing was, you know, sneaking into RoboCop and it's still great, you know, but I wasn't sneaking into documentaries when I was 10. So that just didn't exist as an option. Now you've got docs as a viable option to engage with and spend your time with and learn from or open your mind. And that's another level of quote unquote entertainment, like expanding your consciousness about a thing is exciting. I mean, there's something really engaging there that happens. Because I think you can also have that experience in a stylistic way.
And it's real.
Yes. Right. Right. That goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of there's a limitation with fiction material where at some point, somewhere in your subconscious, no matter how lost you are in it, you know that it's a facsimile. And I love that stuff. I'm not trying to. But the thing that makes docs so special in particular is if you can use real material archive or material that's shot right there, is it's just real. There's nothing you have to dress up about it. And so why I love doc editing is because those are your elements you're sculpting with. And the possibilities of how that material can connect to each other is limitless. So it's exciting and inherently powerful.
And that's a really interesting point about the power of documentary, you know, especially looking at something like Winter on Fire.
I just want to give a brief outline of Will's documentary, Winter on Fire, here, as it will definitely lend perspective to what he goes on to talk about in this next section. Over the course of a harrowing 93 days in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, what started out as a peaceful student demonstration soon became a violent revolution and a fully fledged civil rights movement. The film tells the story of how the country's president turned his back on entering the European Union and used the secret police to violently quash the peaceful protesters that had gathered in the central square of the capital city. But despite the violence being done to them, and despite the fact that the police were shooting and killing many of the protesters, they resisted and showed the world the power of human resilience. It is an extremely engaging film, filled with amazing characters and quite unbelievable footage, much of which was shot on, you know, smartphones and small cameras by members of the public who were right there in the thick of it. The genius in how this narrative is woven together from these hundreds of disparate sources of footage and individual events lies in its really airtight structure and tempo. It is heartbreakingly tragic at times, unbelievable at others, but so emotionally powerful in the film's crescendo and resolution. I thoroughly recommend watching it.
You know, talk to me a bit about that, because I watched that and I was just, the hair on my arms and the back of my neck were, you know, on end for the whole couple of hours there. It was phenomenal. And the power of that and the story that it had to tell. I'd read about some stuff like that in the newspapers. I knew what was going on, but actually getting in there and knowing what was being fought for, what happened, the tragedies and the triumphs. I mean, where else? You're not going to get that in a 2-minute news report. You're not going to get that in 8 inches of newspaper. You know, where else are you going to get tying up the complexities of that situation? It's nowhere else you're going
to
get that.
Well, I think that's a great example to point to in terms of what's the difference between a journalistic presentation of a story and a cinematic presentation of a story. And I was with you. I had barely any notion of what had really gone down in the Ukraine. You can see headlines or maybe even read an article a little something on the news. And so working on that film in a real way exposed what, you know, how wide that gulf is. You know, at any given day, there's thousands, if not millions, of stories with that level of engagement happening on the planet. And they all don't have the opportunity to be filmed at that scale and then put together on a scale like this. But from an editorial perspective, so exciting to work on because, and this is what we were talking about, technology and how docs are different today. You could never make something like that before because that was built out of multiple sources of people filming with their phones, with little cameras constantly. And so the director was able to, and he was on the ground with these people and forming these relationships with people, and became a trusted figure, and they trusted him with all of this footage. And so in the edit bay, there are events and you're trying to parse out, okay, what are the order of events and what's happening and why? And the material you have to paint those colors is so rich, so varied, so real, so present, because it was shot that way. It was shot right there with other human beings, not with these elaborate camera setups, but with their cell phones and it's low rent material like that. But what it gave you was an immediacy. Mm. And we go back to this idea of visceral, trying to create something that's a visceral experience. So that was just shot that way. And there was so much of it and it was so varied. So, and characters emerged out of that footage and via the interviews that were done later. So you're able to key into like, okay, who are our main characters? Because you need people to latch onto to carry you through a thing. If you didn't have that, I don't think the dynamic, incredible footage would have held together per se. So you need a foundation of interesting characters who start at a place and end at a place and have different reactions to the things that are going on. And then you can empathize with them in one way or another. And then you're seeing footage of them, some of them undergoing some of this. And so so much of it was beautifully shot just because it's natural. You get these natural silhouettes, you get these incredible things that are going on, battering rams and these fires and the uniforms of the secret police and the creativity, the sort of mini city that had cropped up. And this, all of this stuff is being covered. So it was really exceptional, like to shoot that much footage and that much material of that much variety in those angles. I mean, it would be hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars if it was a fictional film. And so that was a unique opportunity as an editor to take this material and craft something out of it. But the thing was, for a Western audience, that was what I was focusing on. You know, these things that they're battling for, these things that they're fighting for, they have to be clarified and illuminated. And beyond that, you want to get to a deeper human experience thing. You want to get to the deeper universal humanity of what it is. And that's where we go back to themes. Mm. You know, the textual stuff may be a particular election or a particular law that's passed that's restrictive and that can build. But what you're really talking about is dignity. I mean, someone says it there and that becomes a key moment in the structure of the edit where you reveal the theme, dignity. You know, the people, it's not about the politics and everything else. You're just talking about a pure human thing, which is like, let's be treated with respect. And that's not happening. So again, you're immediately empathizing with these people. You want that for them too.
I'm interested because I remember looking at that and I love the pacing. I knew exactly what was going on at every single moment, which something of that size and that magnitude and that amount of characters and that amount of action is extremely difficult to do from an editing perspective. And I just, firstly, I'd love to know how long you had on that edit. And secondly, how did you go about, did you just break down the actions, the key moments over the 94 days and go, right, let's start working on characters and a theme? How do you start piecing it all together gradually and start and end and then creating the arc?
Sure. I'll start with clarity and I'll go to physical geometry and geography. And so what was great about that is you've got this monument center that's got a tall pillar with the statue on there. And then that becomes the core home for this movement. And you can see it from many different angles and many different perspectives. And so in terms of how do you tell a story of this complexity, clearly you have to know where you are in the square. And it's not just the square and the statue pillar thing there, but there are other landmarks. And it was about putting that at the top of my mind and designing the placement of that so that you were never thinking about where you were. You knew exactly where you were.
So you were constantly feeding in at key moments, maybe at the start of scenes and end of scenes or transitions between the end of one scene and another. You were feeding in visual shots that would allow the audience to connect with the geography.
Yeah. So there's like a series of arches in one place. There's the sort of burnt out bus in another place. And we had graphic maps that helped really nail that.
Yeah, but that was brilliant.
We would often, we'd go back to a side street later that seemed incidental earlier in the film. But when you've planted that landmark, you go back to it. So that really helps in terms of orientation, just the geography of it, making that a visual designed thing. And then in terms of the clarity of the storyline and how it's unfolding, you know, we identified, it's clear, like, okay, people are really here in the middle of this, people are really rising up and are angry about a thing. So what is motivating that? Why are they doing that? And this is me pressing the director. And from an audience perspective, like, I want to know what's going on and I want to know why that's important. And then that would take us like three or four steps back sometimes. This led to this, led to this, led to this. And so it's like, okay, well, we have to show that. And maybe we show that as part of this other thing. It's like origami almost. In terms of you've got to take different story layers and beats and fold them in on themselves in an artful way. Like, I often tell my assistants, like, you're really doing great if you can do two or three things at once. Like, if one edit could accomplish three or four things on your different subtextual layers, then it's singing. It's great. So it wasn't just like, oh, we need to set up this law here and you just slot that in. You know, if you can make that part of the government's just generally inept, this person did this politician, you know, already has this reputation and now he's doing this, and it just activates beats a little bit more when you do it that way. So that was part of the design. That's like the index cards on the wall and where events are placed. So, and then you, again, it's a visual tactile thing. Then I can see the shape of how the film is unfolding just at that sketching out stage of like, all right, this is a core event. It's here in the middle and it's more on the top. Here are three events that lead up to it. And then here are three repercussions of that event, of that particular event. And these repercussions then lead to this other thing. So it was always about making sure everything was connected and there was a clear causality and motivation. One thing leads to another thing, leads to another thing. And being clear on that as I'm putting it together helps me make the right choices so that that's clear for an audience as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that really came across. I'm constantly aware in certain types of documentaries or even films, if I ask myself, where am I? I know I've lost something. I know that something's not been told to me. I know there's a missing rung in the ladder somewhere. And it's like right. a kind of lesson, isn't it? It's like, hold on a minute. I should have been told this. There's certain things you can allow an audience to make an assumption about, but you have to lay the background and the foreground to that pretty strongly and allow them to make that jump themselves. Whereas everything else needs context and setting up and then paying off.
No, that's so right. And that was always top of mind on Winter on Fire, because nobody in the West inherently carries around this knowledge, and it's all in a different language. So it was so complex. So it was always top of mind, making sure we were keeping things clear and visual. And so that was, you know, always, you know, what we were working on to make sure it happened. And without being, you know, pedantic about it, like doing it with panache and in a cinematic way.
Well, talk to me about what you were saying about Hong Kong.
Well, I after I do a film, I have a Google search, or I follow the hashtag for it, just so that I can track a little bit of the conversation around the piece. But I started last summer seeing that Winter on Fire was trending, the hashtag on Instagram. And it was protesters in Hong Kong were actually playing it in the streets during their protests. Like they put up sheets or screens and would actually screen this film.
Wow.
Winter on Fire as a way to motivate themselves and inspire them. And I was blown away by that, because I had said when we were making it, it really felt like it was a handbook for how to do a revolution. I mean, at a certain point, you're really just mapping it out. Yeah. Is what it feels like. It's like, wow, this is how you do it. You know, it's peaceful, it's creative, it's got music and resiliency and clarity of purpose. And because of how it was shot and the amount of material there, and including the president on surveillance footage scurrying away at the end of it, is remarkable material. And so to see some years later that it still had power, and it was still inspiring people. So as someone involved with the creation of it and the construction of it, it's incredible, because I'm going back now to like when I was working on selling hamburgers in the ad world, amongst other things, and feeling like, why am I doing this? What's the purpose of working so hard and applying these talents? And then on the other end of that spectrum, we have something like Winter on Fire, and hopefully everything I work on has some degree of engagement with civilization to move the needle a bit, is always what I'm hoping for on one thing or another. But to see it have so much resonance and something that was actively happening in the world was really humbling. It was really amazing. And I've heard since that even with Black Lives Matter, that Winter on Fire was a inspirational touch point, and they would play it as part of organizing the marches. And so to see that it still has that kind of resiliency, to me, is a justification of, you know, trying to make films that are timeless. That's the goal always.
What a really cool guy Will is, and it was a real pleasure hearing his perspective on our craft. A truly masterful editor. And I highly recommend working your way through his impeccable list of documentaries. Watch them once for pleasure, but watch them twice or even three times to learn. There are so many beautiful little editorial moments and stylizations and designs in the cutting tempo to really drink up and learn from. We're not going to do a Q&A this week, as Will has given us so much fantastic creative editing theory. And you really do not want to miss the second part of Will's interview next week. There is a ton more fascinating creative chat to hear from him. Of course, if you'd like to learn all of the high-end creative techniques that make a professional editor, come and join us over at Inside the Edit. Our creative editing course is specifically designed to turn you into a powerful creative editor. you can sign up to our 14-day trial and get a ton of creative content absolutely free. Just go to insidetheedit.com. A massive shout out to Jessica Danheiser, Paul Saunderson, Richard Canavan, and the London Contemporary Orchestra, who recorded this beautiful film score album at the legendary Abbey Road Studios in London. All the tracks this week were off their Drama Ensemble album, supplied by our friends over at Universal Production Music. I totally love this whole album, and all of the tracks would fit beautifully in any number of inspirational drama or documentary scenes. Go and check the album out on Universal's website. Maybe one of those tracks is perfect for what you're cutting right now. As usual, we've posted the track names and links on this episode's page at podcast.insidetheedit.com. Well, that wraps up yet another episode of Once Upon a Timeline. I really do hope you've enjoyed it. Yep, you know what I'm going to say now. Please don't forget to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It only takes a few seconds and helps us enormously in keeping this completely free resource going. Also, if you think your friends or colleagues or a filmmaking Facebook group you're part of would like our show, please do share this show so that we can grow this community as far and as wide as possible. Have a great week, my dear friends, and I'll see you very soon on another episode of Once Upon a Timeline. Stay cool, stay safe, and above all, stay cutting.